I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings, which is an ongoing series I think all of you know about. I think this is a particularly exciting Tuesday evening series. I know you can't trust me because I have a tendency to say that about all of them, but just come and see if you don't agree with me. The lineup, I think, is remarkable this spring with a whole lot of variation, some surprises for what has become sort of the norm for a program that was built on being abnormal or having a lot of variety. So this is good. It's shaking it up. It's really, really exciting, I think. Next week we have the filmmaker John Smith here. He's here from London to present a selection of short films and to talk about the ideas that have shaped his art over the past four decades. In his presentation that he's entitled Real Fiction, John's pretty spectacular. Somebody was asking, can we look at his work? His name is John Smith, so you need to be specific when you Google him. Filmmaker from London. But I think you can probably find it. And I really recommend you to be here. I don't want anybody to have any regrets, miss it and have any regrets. As announced, to allow for proper time for the screening of the films, John's lecture is scheduled from 7 to 8:30. So like I said, try to make it so you don't have any regrets. I think it's sure to be entertaining and enlightening and worth your time and money. I know that many of you enjoyed last week's lecture because I've heard from a lot of you to that end. Joe did, I think, a great job opening the Warhol The Last Decade exhibition. Speaking of the Warhol show, I want to use this opportunity to remind you of a new program, artist-led tours at 1 p.m. each Sunday through the run of this exhibition. Check out the lineup on the website. It's a good place to find it, where you can also find, of course, the Tuesday evening schedule. We had a really big crowd for Richard Patterson. He did a great job this past Sunday opening the exhibition and the series of tours, and we are expecting the same from the L.A.-based artist James Gilbert, who will be here this coming Sunday. So just meet us at the top of the stairs outside of the Warhol exhibition at 1 o'clock, and promise to please. And, of course, tonight's presentation is in advance of the opening of our upcoming Focus, Gabriel Acevedo Velarde, which opens to the public this coming weekend. Gabriel is here installing the exhibition, which if you've had a chance to peek over the stanchions at the back gallery on the first floor, it is a very intriguing installation that incorporates brightly colored tent-like structures and more. Very intriguing, very interesting. I'm anxious to see it completed, and I'm also anxious to get some insights into it tonight. Gabriel's work is a narrative mix of multimedia installations, performances, as well as drawings and films that are informed by different cultural points of view experienced in his travels in various relocations in Latin America, the U.S., and Europe. Born in Lima, Peru, Gabriel went to school in Puebla, Mexico, where he received his BFA. He went on to attend film school in Mexico City and now lives and works in Berlin, Germany. Gabriel's projects have been exhibited in museums and galleries in Sao Paulo, Mexico City, Lima, London, Madrid, Frankfurt, Berlin, Geneva, and New York. The Modern's Focus exhibition, curated by Andrea Carnes, marks Gabriel's first solo show in an American museum. As I said, the Tuesday evening series seems to hold a lot of surprises and promises of something a little different this time. And tonight, for example, Gabriel will begin by presenting his work and follow with something a little different. So sit back, enjoy the show as soon as we've all given Gabriel a round of applause and welcome.
Hello. I want to thank Terry's words, and Andrea for the invitation, and everybody in the museum crew has been fantastic with me. Hello. I wrote this speech up. I decided to improvise my performance and lecture about my work. I wanted to merge both, and I had this great idea of improvising completely. And I went back to take a nap, and then I couldn't handle it, so I wrote a speech. But anyway, it's about my work, and it has a sort of performative thing. So maybe we can turn the lights a bit off. Down. Okay. When you see the show, you may see a plane on the floor. Then you're gonna see another plane that is sort of elevating from that first plane, and then a volume made out of planes that goes something like this. There is a progression that I wanted to show from something recognizable as an art piece, which would be the first plane, which is like a sculpture, with something that you could walk into, which would be the tent. I like to think of the fabric material that I'm using as a kind of skin. One time I was in my apartment in Berlin. I didn't smoke like cigarettes 2 or 3 years ago. This started gradually, like as I would say, like 1 year and a half ago or 2 years. And when I started smoking, I still smoked in a sort of ritual way. It's not like that I smoke every day. I smoke maybe 2 or 3 cigarettes by day with this rolled tobacco. And when I started, I used to have like my smoking time. I mean, I guess every smoker has that. But as you smoke more and more, I guess you lose the ritual part, or maybe the ritual part contaminates too much the rest of the everyday life. However, I used to shut down the lights of my living room studio and lay on the sofa and light the cigarette. And because they were like the first times that I smoked alone in my house, I would take care a lot of not getting like any ash in the, you know, in the fingers or in my body. So I was pretty aware all the time of the ashes problem. So I would smoke and quickly throw the ashes and not smoke like relaxed. As I continued smoking, this started to happen. And this is, you know, when a small piece of ash that is still burning, I don't know how you say that. I guess you understand me, of course. I hope. Like a small piece of burning ash burned my finger, you know? And I would go like, damn. It's happening. Like, I'm so stupid, but at the same time, I was I say glad that I was relaxing with smoking, and then the nice thing started to happen that as I was holding the cigarette, let's say this is my finger, whoops, and these are my other fingers, let's say this is my finger. Smoking a cigarette here. Okay. Yeah, more or less. A piece of ash would fall, let's say, onto here. And then I kept thinking on this, that I felt just like one dot, like as somebody, how to say, pinching you with a needle, you say that? Anyway. And I kept thinking, like, wow, this is maybe one nerve end, you know, like this piece of burning ash is burning just the end of one nerve, one little nerve. It's not two. It's not an area that hurts. It's just one. It's like a dot. So that made me think that the dot is a notion where idea and the physical experience of it merge. That the representation of the visual or sensorial representation of of a dot is the same as the idea of a dot. I'm not sure if you are following me, but I'm going to explain more of this. I like to think that the definition of myself is a dot, like something without any dimension. And let me be ambitious and childish with this consideration. The idea of a dot matches perfectly the feeling of one termination. If you close your eyes and softly sting yourself with a needle, you're going to find that a dot might be the only idea that one can experience physically. I wonder if that statement, wrong or not, could be yet the beginning, like the primal scream of a larger argumentation. So far, I cannot give you the large argumentation because I don't have it yet. Maybe I won't ever have it, but I can give you a cascade of thoughts that depart from this. When I think of what is to say, to communicate, I always think of a cone. Something departs from somewhere and expands in more or less in a more or less wide angle, spreading in space, like the sound of my voice. As you're trying to understand what I'm saying in my not so fluent English, you are perhaps also trying to understand the place where the things I'm saying come from. Despite me being a human person or a human being speaking, I am also an area of space, because I am, like anyone else, an area where many elements cross. So when you're listening to me, you're actually listening to a place that walks and talks. Now, this place is not a fixed place. As anybody, you've traveled or you've met people from different places, or you've heard music from different places, or read books from different places. So the what I say place, I don't mean necessarily a fixed place in the classic sense. A few months ago, 3 months ago, I was watching this documentary on Kraftwerk, the German band. And maybe the only Kraftwerk guy that the documentarians managed to interview was Karl Bartos, which is not the main one of the main two Kraftwerk guys, but however, he's explaining why they were doing what they were doing. And he's saying that for them it was so important to recognize that they were Germans, and they had to communicate through their music where they came from. Kraftwerk, as opposed to all the contemporary to them, German bands of this German electronic music scene in the 70s. Were the only ones who had a name in German, which is Kraftwerk, which means electricity power factory generator, I don't know. Anyway, when he is explaining this, he says that as composer, when you make music, you have to be clear on the place you are composing from. And then he says, as part of the same, as if it was part of the same thought or this, nearly the same words, he says, to compose something, you have to be clear on the direction you are taking. If you have a direction, you know where you go and you know what to play and what to compose. You have to have a direction, a place. Okay, this was like fascinating for me because although it looks like a mistake to talk, like not to express himself not so clearly. He says like place and direction, which are different things. I think the mistake itself tells a lot of this place that music can describe or become. Music, it's both a place and a direction. And it is so interesting because Karl Bartos is not talking, in abstract terms about music and the composer. He's talking about the identity of Germans. So it's not only a place and a direction, but it's a place and a direction that imply political and a commitment of identity. It's like a political commitment of identity. I mean, anyway. Keeping going. You can go further. I wrote this a couple of minutes ago. You can go further and think that to overlap direction and place also mixes something material, like the idea of a dot, something material, a place with something conceptual, the subjective experience of movement or direction. So like the dot and the nerve termination, place and direction also give a puzzling materiality to the idea of consciousness. Anyway, words, I wrote this also, and I like it a lot. Anyway, words have sometimes an hypnotical resonance, so I'll move on. It's really funny, because I think like many, if you, it's something you see a lot of like in contemporary art, you find this I mean, and sometimes it's good, of course, but this frames or pictures with just one phrase, and that it's supposed to be super, I don't know, deep, or you know, that plays with the idea of being superficial and deep at the same time, and it can be. But then every time I see one of these, I remember the comment about that of a friend that is a writer. He told me that visual artists overvalue the power of words. Anyway, so I won't do it. But anyway, and on parallelly, and this is like more in the middle of last year, I was thinking in going back to Peru, where I come from. I spent 10 years out of Peru. I left when I was 23 in the year 2000 because of a lot of personal reasons and other reasons that are personal but are also political, although I couldn't, in those times, refer to them as political. In particular, I was bothered by the ego model that I was taught, and the ego model that is the, how do you say, the reigning power. I'm not sure if I'm explaining myself, but I felt that I had no narrative, that the environment where I was, Lima, didn't give me a narrative that I could identify with. So I left Peru in search for that narrative and escaping from this ego thing that I dislike so much. That search of the perfect place without ego, of course, which is absurd, because that such place doesn't exist. But the place in my experience that got closer to that ideal place so far is Berlin. For a series of reasons, I felt there that somehow the egometer is really low. Yeah, no, even it's funny because look, you come from Lima, and then you go to I went to Mexico first, which is really similar to Peru. I found the same thing. Then I go to Brazil, and I find the same thing. Like this, like I can flow there because the codes, even the way I walk in the street in Lima or in Mexico or in Sao Paulo are super similar. I'm basically defending myself all the time, watching my back. Trying to deal things with, I don't know, with the taxi driver, you know, everybody jumps on you, everybody wants to get on top of you. And you know, and then I was saying it's funny because then you go to Europe, which is maybe so different, and in London is maybe the same or even more cannibal or as cannibal as Sao Paulo. Spain, of course, the same. Italy, woo! Like, macho ego big time. But then in Berlin, maybe for the historical reasons that we all know, masculine ego is really low, I don't know. And you don't find so many people that want to like say step on you. And this reminds me of, and the previous thing as well, of my mother. I went back to Peru to make connection with Peru again, and because I like music so much, and I'm developing this musical project. It's like I wanted to approach Peruvians through their musical taste. And in particular, I was interested, or I am interested in what prejudices people have against any genre of music, because I was raised with a big prejudice. So now that I'm back to Peru, and you'll see it in two videos. In one video, I interview my mom and my dad to trace back the history of this prejudice against pop music, in particularly American and European pop music. And then in the other video, I interview people in the street in some areas that are of like new, let's say, development in Lima, to search for new prejudices or old prejudices, or what's going on with the borders drawn by this place direction that is music. I had this prejudice against pop music, which from which I'm completely cured. Because of a series of reasons, mainly, I think it's my father, but it was also my mother in a different way for being part of the same situation. I will rapidly talk about this. I was raised like both my parents are really lefty. My father makes comics and political caricature, and he was really into politics and publishing comic strips and political caricature in the late 70s and all the 80s. Peruvian dictatorship, I mean, a dictatorial government was in Peru until 1980. Of course, then we had Fujimori, which was also a dictator, but that's different. And during the same years, I mean, the late 70s, my mom got into this feminist NGO. So the normal issues discussed every day at the table were politics, and when friends of my dad's, of my parents came home, they discussed politics, and even now when I go to Peru, all my friends and my family discuss about politics. Every day is politics, and if you don't like politics or talk about politics, it can be a headache. But one interesting thing happened. I interviewed my dad, and I found again many things that I could recognize as the origin of this prejudice against pop music, because pop music translated, or was easily translated into American imperialism trying to penetrate the country and alienate us all with consumerism and capitalism. And my dad, of course, was lefty, so he didn't want that to happen. So he educated us since really early age with this skepticalism about something we actually didn't understand quite well when we were so young. And it was useful on one side, because we could, like, it was silly, but we could differentiate in my classroom which other friends came from similar families and which other don't. And it was like, I mean, I was, of course, like 9 or 10 years old, so it was like the Matrix. Like, they who know that all that happens in TV is like to catch you like a fish or something, and they who don't, and we who know how things go, right? Something like that. Of course, it was pretty arrogant, and it led to us, the children of this lefty elite, to grow this unfundamented, you say? This unfounded arrogance against everything, every cultural product coming from pop culture, which was like a silly rejection in many ways. So we were like the new novelty, like the inheritors of this reign, the utopian lefty government that was supposed to come, but it never came. So the arrogance, instead of breaking up and seeing like the real things, the complex real thing, reality is, I guess. The arrogance, of course, drew back, you say, and there was like a sort of a melancholic approach towards pop music. It's like we rejected it, and I talk like of we. We rejected it, but with a certain longing for not having us in the late 80s, let's say, a music that would gather us as much as the music of the 70s did with my parents' generation. Anyway, back to the interviews. When I did the interview to my dad, this worked perfectly. I found many surprises, as you will see in the video. But then, when I went to interview my mom, the same approach didn't work. And it's fascinating the reason why it didn't work, which is that my mother was not like so full of ideology as my dad. My mom was like an intuitive feminist. And my dad was also an intuitive lefty in a way. But being a man, you could read this and that texts. You could get the newspapers and sort of know from a mixture of reading and intuition, know what to criticize. So my dad had maybe in that sense the work. A bit easier, although my dad worked a lot. But my mom, being a woman, she got some texts, like feminist texts from Europe that didn't apply exactly to the Peruvian women reality. Peruvian women reality. And but also, she didn't have, and this is what is so interesting to me, she didn't have texts or any theoretical narrative that explained her real concerns, which were more personal and intimate than the big politics traditional idea of politicians, etc. As my dad, like, the politics that she was concerned about were more the politics of the familiar life and the politics of the relationship, of her relationship with her body. Now, this that sounds so like ethereal. She explained to me, she didn't explain it to me. I had to ask her a lot of questions. But in an intuitive way, he told me something that is, I think, highly pertinent for contemporary art. She told me that that she liked all these hymns, you say? Hymnos? Like all the, yeah, hymns. And songs about the revolution and all the, like, the Cuban songs and the Argentinian, Chilean, Brazilian songs of the lefty musicians. And she did, that music did make her feel part of this movement, and she truly believed that they were gonna overcome the conservative society and grow this new fair society, fair for all. But not quite. It's like in the intimate life, she didn't play that music for you know, at home. Something didn't work like so fluently as when she was in a big demonstration or with friends. I mean, in group. That only happened when, after, my mom and some other friends from this feminist NGO. Did you hear me? I see some faces, like, with funny... Okay. Anyway. my mother and some other friends from her feminist NGO got all these books from Europe. They couldn't apply them to their circumstances. And they did a brilliant thing of accepting that they were not prepared to try to, how to say, inject women's rights values and necessity into Peruvian women from let's say, economically speaking, lower classes, unless they were coherent in their personal lives to the or with the things that they were supposedly gonna teach. So they made this group activities, like every week they would meet with these friends, like small groups of five women, to interchange the experiences, hard experiences of their lives with each other. But not only like to say, you know, I guess someone ran into my dog and it made me cry or something like that, but the experiences they had as women and what women and what meant to be a woman in those times. So when I heard this, I interpret, of course, she didn't have this narrative that she could identify with, which is what I just said at the beginning of the speech. And then she said that by doing these activities during, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, I think, she could not only overcome like a personal sad circumstance that she had lived, but also to integrate what she wanted to do politically, although she didn't say it was politics, and it is politics, with her personal life. So it was like a more organic organization of her activity, like her direction, and what he was. It's like the place where she came from, and the places, emotional places and life places where she came from. And that had a direct result, like really material result, touchable result, in her way of experiencing music. All of a sudden, she could dance wildly and enjoy music and enjoy her body for I'm not sure the first time, but for the first time in a intense and like organic way. I think if I had heard this 10 years ago, I would have said, of course, like girls or something like that. It was like that, the body and all that, like I could express myself. That didn't sound that important as it sounds to me now. Like, I think there is a whole narrative that should come from women that is like it's arriving progressively, but it's like we still have to go a long way in that. I mean, yeah, I think so. Yeah, but there could be much more theory about this, but there is yet none. And that doesn't mean that it's not important. Anyway, we should value that. Anyway, I got a bit lost. Okay, but what I mean is that it's so interesting that my mom shares that point with my dad in an analog way. My dad also never... never was into a political party because he was so individualist. He didn't like the notion, something like he didn't like the notion of mass. Mass of people in the 70s way that the lefty parties of how the lefty parties represented the people, you know, like the worker as a fighter and like a superhero fighter. Anyway, So anyway, like the to put both videos at the same time, the one in which I trace back this prejudice of mine about pop culture, interviewing my family, and to put on the other side the video of me interviewing people in the street, trying to find new prejudices. I think it should work like a way of locating, I mean, for the visitors of the exhibition to place myself in a specific context. And now I'm speaking about a specific place, Peru. So that you know, I mean, where I come from, like in a very plain way. And this is because I think that I'm not sure if I said this at the beginning. Like I wanted to do this exhibition as a progression. That's why then the name is cone flow, going from the cone still there. I haven't drawn anything anyway. From a dot to a circle, to a three-dimensional circle, in the sense of having things that are recognizable as art pieces and have other things that are recognizable as direct, straight communication, speech. I think in contemporary art, you have more and more like the piece and the text that explains the piece, which of course is not bad in itself, and you can have great pieces and great art in that sort of genre, but it is as if it was a genre already, like the piece and the text. And I think by doing that, artists not only promote whatever ideas they are trying to reflect on, but also they're promoting that separation, which to me it seems a bit an absurd thing to do if you're only doing that. So as everybody else here, I guess, I like art, but I wanted to do is like to put an art piece and to put like a transition between this mysterious art piece, which is the first one, and somewhere where you can meet who I am in a very plain way. Of course, I'm telling you my life story, but a bit, yes. At the end, by doing this, what I'm trying to do is to criticize the idea of cultural elitism for being so narcissistic. And narcissism is a defensive attitude. Cultural elitism, as any elitism, is defined by its will of status, a will for drawing clear borders around itself. But why do we need to draw borders? I would like to be more committed to the understanding of borders as a complex living tissue, because at the end, some borders are, it's horrible to say this, but it's like borders that define things. The definitions are, you know, are separation of things and say this is this and this is not that, blah, blah, blah. But as organizations of energy grow bigger, like a person or a group of persons or a country, then the idea of borders grow also more unnecessary to me. So I think we would have to work more in understanding and rebuilding borders as a sort of like organic tissue where things mix as they should mix. That's it. Any question? That was my speech. Anyway, I can show you a bit of. I want also to show you some pictures of Peru and comment on them. Hold on. Do we still have time? Like 10 minutes? Okay, no problem. Okay, this is the model of a piece you're gonna see. Some models I did in Peru. Hold on, photos. This work that is a bit hard to see. It's a picture of sand. Do you hear me? Yeah. Picture of sand taken with my cell phone. And although you cannot see it there, well, maybe you can sort of you make an effort. There's some like stains of magenta and some other stains of cyan. Cyan is that? I'm sure you can see them, but maybe you can see them more when it's in the and on the screen in my cell phone. Lima has this crazy thing of being 50 meters above sea level. And it has this crazy thing of having a lot of fog coming from the ocean. So if you go to this natural balcony that Lima is, in a foggy day, you see it below, and there should be normally a highway that goes by the beach. And when it's too foggy, you don't even see the highway. But because it's fog, it's not even clouds, there are not even shades of gray. So it's white here, and the same white here, and the same white here, and the same white there, and it's just white, like a photographer's studio. I think this is a one isolated comment, but that, I think somehow it's like it tells a lot about the specific nostalgia from Lima and the specific sense of as an insular sense, like you feel that you're an island. In Peru, you feel like isolated, not only far away from Europe or the States or wherever else in the world, but you also feel like isolated from everything around you. So in a way, I was thinking of this in this trip. It's like as if this wall, like the perfect circular wall of fog, wouldn't allow you to see how things are so different in society. I'm not sure if I'm explaining myself, but it's like you take for granted that things are like that, like eternal, like forever. So you won't do that because you will never leave from this island, and it's useless to try to do something to change things. I don't know. In Peru, there's a lot of racism. It's really crazy. I'm going to show you something interesting. Any kid here? No. This is from Mars. Okay. Although it's a joke, it's not from Mars. It's from a Peruvian pre-Hispanic culture, pre-Inca culture even, called the Mochicas. It's really funny that we try to think of how extraterrestrial life is when you have something like this and don't understand what is it about, like, at all. There's a lot of historians, of course, and archaeologists that have managed to figure out what this culture was about. But what is so sad of going to Peruvian museums, being a Peruvian, is that you don't have any link to any of these pieces. Why? Because, I mean, the Spanish conquest was so cruel and so drastic. Then what is amazing in contemporary Peru is a situation like this. We have also the Chan Chan, this pre-Hispanic, pre-Inca well, city. I think it's from like 300 or 400 D.C., and it's like made of adobe with a lot of reliefs, like carved sculptures and figures, and anyway, I got it from them.
2 months ago, a bunch of teenagers in a school trip, like let's say 14, 15 years old, destroyed, like kicking some details of these things, which, by the way, they are, let's say, remade. Remade by the archaeologists and those guys. But anyway, these teenagers not only made that destruction, but made a video of it because they thought it was so funny and uploaded to YouTube. And made like all kind of comments promoting the video on YouTube, in Twitter, etc., etc. Of course, the press got to know it really fast because of this. And you had like in a couple of days this huge scandal in Peruvian society about how come these teenagers had done this. Of course, all the scandal was about it's because education is not good. We're not teaching our children how important is our patrimonio, our inheritance, or something. But then you went amazingly to the YouTube video comments, and I didn't count them, but I spent like I don't know half an hour reading like some 150 comments. Half of them were openly racist. Like they said Indios de mierda, which is like something like then Indio, let's say. Then Indios had to have done this, something like that. Like it had to be them. Because the students were like dark skinned, like Indios and racially Indios. What is of course crazy is not only that open expression of racism, but like the complete lack of any notion that it was Indians who made China in the first place, and Indians who are the most part of Peruvians. So it's really crazy that a society has, I mean, and actually not that unusual, in the world, that we have turned these ruins into furniture. They're furniture. When anybody like, makes a scratch on the furniture, people like, scream. But when you hear Indio de mierda in the street, nobody says nothing. So it's like image has become this thing that we have to praise without praising the actual living ruins, so the living organism, the living thing. Yes.
Can I ask this?
Sure.
Do you think that your approach and your interest in how thought is developed and how culture is developed and I'm not expressing that very well, but do you think the way you seem to deconstruct and reconstruct thought to get to your ideas about art, and it sounds like about life, do you think they would be as they are, or that you would be interested in that if you hadn't had the upbringing that you had, something to play it against, and something that actually probably encouraged thinking and deconstructing thought? Growing up in your family, with all of the conversation that happened,
yeah, of course.
Even in that culture, you know, something to resist against in a way, but also permission to explore that.
In many ways it was a blessing that my dad was such a skeptical. It was in many ways a blessing. Also, like, also it's crazy, maybe it's something that runs in the, I don't know, my brother also remember being 9 years old, and my brother was 11, or maybe even less. Yes, even less, because we were in the other house, so it was at least, I was at most 8 and my brother 10. And he told me, like he turned to me one day and told me, Gabriel, everything is determined. You're not free. all our choices depend on are a result of a lot of consequences and patterns. And I remember like an explosion. So we were like, I don't know, he was like a natural postmodernist. Really, and I remember being depressed for this, like a long time. No, not depressed for this, but I remember, you know, so like such a powerful idea. And it's so powerful because we don't live, because it's, I guess, so hard to live with the acceptance that meaning doesn't exist. Or that meaning, that we make meaning exist, but it's like a convention, it's like the way we are inventing this game to play real life.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what it is, but it's really hard work to get confronted with the unmeaningfulness of reality. So, anything else? Questions? Comments?
I have a question. So when you interviewed Peruvians, you haven't been to Peru in 10 years, and you're interviewing people about music, do you think that pop music has a different meaning there now than 10 years ago when you were in Peru? I mean, what did you find through interviewing these people about the influence on music on them?
I want to find, like, as I said, following this conception of music as a territory that moves. You have this sub territory, and the first interesting thing that I found was that many people, I guess I would answer the same way if someone would ask me what genre of music I like. Everybody would answer, I like everything. You know, I like everything, I like every kind of thing. And only after like pushing them a bit, they would say, no, I like this more and that, this or this genre. Well, of course, I like anyone else. But then, I noticed that there was something else behind that or something. And a guy that worked the door of a club, gave me his theory on the subject. He told me that people that like música variada, like diverse music, are from a higher class than music that people that like a specific genre, which of course sounds crazy, but if you think of globalization and you think of the sons of families that are recent immigrants from the Andes, from the mountains region in Peru, coming to the city, of course, to know a lot of genre, a diversity of culture, means that you are, it's real, that you have more power and you have a higher status somehow, because you're culturally richer. Of course, like Peruvians, we tend to find any reason to draw these limits, this status limits. I also found like a new prejudice against chicha music. Chicha music represented and it still represents immigrants from the Andes. And as it does that, it represented all the frustration of the immigrants and the aggressivity of Lima towards them. So in the late 80s and in the 90s, chicha parties were already a bit violent, maybe people got drunk, men that fought, etc. So now this crystallized completely, and many people have this straight prejudice against chicha music because of being of criminals. Chicha music is criminals. You have other people that are closer maybe to these families that like a lot of chicha music in a very intense way. But there is already the clear border of like a new generation of young people that grew in a more comfortable economic of the comfortable circumstances that have this the value of not being close to criminals as a very strong value, which before it was not so clear, not so, let's say, right, the border. In that, it's also funny that I'm thinking about this a lot, like how Peruvians, I mean, and me also, it happens with me, we identify with salsa, with cumbia, and with this swing coming from God knows where, and it comes from the Caribbean. All of it comes from the Caribbean. And it's, of course, since Mambo ages, the impact was so huge in Latin America that it's like everybody feels I also feel identified from like that music. But it's just funny that all that music doesn't come from Peru exactly. And even cumbia comes from Colombia, from the Caribbean part of Colombia, Peru. So, but now even in Argentina, which is so different culturally as Chile from the rest of South America and Latin America, cumbia is super big in Argentina, and it's big in the peripheral areas, in the rough areas of Buenos Aires. From the hills. And it's a completely different cumbia, but still it's cumbia. I would say cumbia is a more international genre in Latin America.
I was just curious about your thinking behind this this event that we're at right now. Because you talked about sort of the performance and the speech that you were going to do, and it's interesting because like the sort of the traditional kind of artist talk often has like a series of images that someone has done already, and then there's a series of stories that go along with it, and many of the things that you brought were sort of like the drawn diagrams or a photograph of a model for something, and sort of like verbal stories, but nothing was like a representation of something that we might mistake for being the real thing. So I was thinking that in some ways you were trying to, like that this was the artwork, and I'm wondering if that's right or wrong.
I don't know, it's like the artwork is like, a, I mean, I couldn't say the artwork is like this or that, but it sounds like too big, I don't know. But I don't know, it feels like the artwork is like it's like dead or something. I don't know, because it's the end of the process. It's like the nail that grows and then you cut it, and that's it. You know? It's a part of your body that goes out. I won't make any comment for it. Yeah, it's there like forever, or it's supposed to be there forever. Yeah, no, because there's one philosopher called Mladen Dollar. His last name is actually Dollar. He's from Croatia. And he compares a lot. Actually, that's a nice way. He compares book with the voice. He says the voice is like it's like something you can't explain that goes out of it. Also, book has a material thing. It's really hard to talk about the voice. It is so between something physical and something that is very, very, very inside you. It's inside you, but it's outside you. You know what I mean? It's like, so I don't know, I would say, if you ask me plainly, I would say the artwork is that. And I would plainly say that this is the process. But a friend of my dad, a poet, has a very cheesy way to put it, but it's a nice way. He would explain to my dad why he was not writing poetry at some moment, I don't know. And he told my dad something like, like to write poetry, you have to live in poetry. And right now I'm living in poetry. So, I was saying, like, not that I'm living in poetry, but when you're doing this, it's like you're living it. And it sounds much more poetic than it actually is. It's like every day, like the butter on the bread. It's pretty much a good thing. Impressive. Yes?
You said something about ego.
Ego.
I want to ask you this question. First one is that, do you think your qualification of ego is about the political situation in those countries you mean?
Hello.
Can you say something about ego?
Ego.
Like, is there Peru, the moon?
Ah, that's not really ego, whatever.
And your definition of ego, is it about the political situation in those countries? That's my first question. The second question is that, you choose to live in Germany, what we read. Like, go back 17 years ago. Do you think you were living in Germany?
17 years ago?
70, like 70.
In 1970?
No, 70 years ago, like 1935. You think you would choose to live in Germany? And you really think the Second World War, the situation that happened around everything in the Second World War, kind of shaped Germany to be what Germany is today?
It's hard to say that the 70 years ago I would have liked to live in Germany. If someone asked me if I wanted to get transported to 1935 Germany, I would say yes, in a second. As in anywhere else in the history of time. But definitely, I think Germany, it's really like a complex issue in Germany, ego. And it's funny, you live in Berlin, and it's really hard outside to explain. To find people that want to step on you. Like in the common person-to-person everyday routine. But you go to Hamburg only, and you feel somehow that you're more like in a city. And you perceive, or you realize that Berlin is more like a town, where people say hi, and people are nice to each other. I mean, I don't want to idealize Berlin, but I'm just explaining why I like it so much. And I think immediately why Hamburg is more like a city and has more of this common aggressivity of, I think, inherent to a city. Because Hamburg is more capitalist. Hamburg is poor, centuries ago, and has commerce, and with commerce comes tricks, commercial tricks, and commercial tricks come like all these, like, I don't know how to explain in English, but this capitalist ego, I don't know.
So that means you're kind of in search for a society where capitalism prevails.
Yeah, the thing is that search is impossible. It's like I live in Berlin because I feel more comfortable there. Of course, then so was Andrea in the morning. You live in Berlin for I live in Berlin like the first 1-2 years, and I was like on the same like person in the sky all the time. In my head, I had idealized Berlin completely. Then, of course, reading a bit, you get to know that 25% of Berliners live in the government completely. They have no jobs, and they receive, I don't know, from 500 to 800 euros a month.
So you're interested in communism?
What's that?
Are you interested in communism? Capitalism?
I?
Yes.
No. I mean, I would like to live in a communist country, honestly. I mean, because there are some communist countries that are open now, but well, maybe it would be. But what I wanted to say is that, I mean, of course, there's no perfect place. But I feel super comfortable in Berlin for a situation that is a bit fictitious. That is, like, also, like, I think Berlin, during all the Cold War years, was artificially, I mean, West Berlin was artificially sustained by West Germany, and of course by the state and all the, like the Allies. This created a whole I think psychology of the Berliner, or of the post-war Berliner, that is used to being maintained. So now you go to Berlin, and of course everybody is so cool about you putting graffiti in the wall, because it's like a Berlin to maintain kit, like a cool kit. In some way, I also don't want to talk about it. It's a complex question with many actors, right? However, if you take it, you can dislike it or like it. I mean, many, most of people like Berlin, as me. Because even though all this situation, if you get skeptical, the fact is that you're comfortable there. There are very different people living really close to each other and in a peaceful way. Not that I want to live always in Berlin, nor that I think it's the perfect city in the perfect world, and we should all imitate it, but I just feel good there. And regarding what is the ego that I hate, for instance, this is pretty funny, and it's also like one point of loving these details. I was once in London for the first time, and I used the line to get the tickets in the subway, getting the machine, you know? And I didn't know how to do it, like if I get a card or what. And I turned to the guy that is behind me. He's like 40 years old, I guess regular looking Londoner. And I go like, hey, sorry, it's my first time in London and I don't know how to... Good luck! In my face.
So I think what everybody in this audience experienced that in foreign missions. Almost everybody in this audience have experienced that in any foreign country. So doesn't like experience that 50 million Londoners, I'd be like 50 million people in Britain. You have this, like one experience, one situation out of 60 million people living in England.
Of course, but I would live the same situation in London several times.
And like how many times?
Always. Okay, I'm sorry. In New York, the same, another nice people, and not that that's a million, that's actually like a super brand. Of course, I would be nice, isn't it? All I'm saying is that somehow capitalism or like any ideology or any economical system or social or cultural system expresses itself in the people. It's not only like in billboards. Billboards are everything is built by people. And as you can find that in negotiating a deal, you find that in how the waiter comes to you in the restaurant, how the bus driver treats you, how you treat the bus driver, etc., etc. So like a million of tiny elements, details that make our life. And for some reason, I'm super sensitive to ego, so I can smell it.
Hey, Gabriel.
Yeah.
I think that you and Nini need to go out for a beer.
Yeah.
I think our time is up. I wish this performance had happened in a bar.
Yeah.
That was great.